go to thecognitiverampage.com. Feel free to contribute, donate, keep fueling the change, whatever it is that you guys can do to help continue to allow this to happen. None of this would happen without you and your love and your support and, of course, your contributions. Love you.
Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. My book, The Cognitive Rampage, A Scientific Approach to Self-Discovery, Change, and Life Optimization, is now available on Amazon. What I do in the book is I fuse the latest research from the cognitive, behavioral, social, environmental, and biological sciences. It's not just motivational fluff and wordplay. Now, I do talk about my own story, so there's some kind of inspiration in there, but I'm not just spinning words and hyping you up with motivational fluff. Whether you need a life change, simply enjoy self-exploration and optimization, want to discover new hidden passions, or reduce the life-altering effects of toil, anxiety, depression, all of those issues, this book is for you. This book is not a cookie-cutter method of steps to follow. You'll customize the scientific framework with your own personal beliefs to build your authentic change. That way you assimilate it faster and quicker. It's not just copying my beliefs and telling you step one, step two. These will come from your beliefs as how you extend and build the foundation upon this framework. You'll use this framework throughout your whole life, through every change, and through every age. These are not empty words of motivational spin. This book is an experience. The Cognitive Rampage is based in science and is built from your beliefs. It's a path to help you unleash your desired change. You can apply this method on your own with no harmful side effects. You can simply go to Amazon.com, search The Cognitive Rampage, and you'll find the second edition there, as well as the Kindle version. The audiobook is going to be released sometime in June. Sometime in June, I will have the audiobook of the second edition available as well. Now, you can also mental train at cognitiverampage.com. You can mental train with me one-on-one, right? It's your own personal cognitive rampage. I do four types, really. I do mental training where I'm practicing with you in the present and I'm teaching you psychological tools and strategies to apply in your life in the present moment, in the now, right? We're not going to run through your childhood or cultivate or talk about the traumas that have impacted you over time. The idea is to handle in the present with tools and strategies that are effective and proven by science that you can do with yourself. Now, that's the first part of mental training. The second part that I do is I do minimalist training. I'm a minimalist. I live that lifestyle. And a lot of people, well, they want to, but they're not sure. What I help you do is I coach you through what to expect, down to what to get, and what you'll go through, even where to start. So we do minimalist training as well. And the third type of training I do is book and podcast training, meaning help you write the book, tell you what's included, what to expect, what you got to go through, some tricks of the trade that I learned publishing my two books, as well as if you have a podcast, if you're just starting out with a podcast and you want to do well on social media, right? You want to get the rankings, you want to learn more about it, how to do it, down to the gear that you need, what you should expect, and again, some tricks from the trade that I've learned through the Cognitive Rampage podcast, I'm more than happy to share with you. And that leads to my last bit of training, which is social media. I teach you what you need, how to get it started, and show you how to run it yourself, all right? So mental training is available. That's at adamlowry.com as well. Welcome, everybody. My guest today is Dr. Robert Duff, a author, best-selling author, I should add, being an author myself. That is something I wish I could add in front of my name. So, dang it, I'm going to say it for the man himself who earned it. But best-selling author of the mental health book series, Fuck Depression and Fuck Anxiety. And I say that with extreme emphasis without trying to use too many complicated words, as I'm sure you'll let us know. Robert, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for having me. It's a nice Friday here, so good way to end off the day, you know, start the weekend.
You got plans this weekend? What you getting into?
No plans, and that's a change, which is a very good thing. Trying to keep it boring.
Hey, no qualms with that, man. I'm headed out this weekend. It's my birthday on Monday, so I'm going surfing over in Florida, back where I'm from. I'm out here on the West Coast with you.
Yeah, where in California are you? Are you northern or southern?
Oh, no, I'm in the awkward desert place where we operate on California time, even though we're in mountain zone.
My bad. Gotcha.
I put that now directly because it was when I first came out here to the desert, it was awkward being in Arizona. And I book, say, a guy in Colorado and I missed it by an hour and he's all upset. And I'm going, what do you mean? And he's like, oh, Arizona is the only smart state that doesn't observe daylight savings time.
Yeah, that's fun. That's fun.
I think they even pay like some sort of federal fine for not observing it or something like that.
I believe it.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. I think we should all switch anyway. But I was obviously turned on to your books, etc. I love the titles, by the way. I think that was genius. Now, did they make you put the asterisks?
No, I put it in there just because I thought it'd be a smart idea, you know. And that's actually, you know, the reason I have my series is called Hardcore Self Help is because I wanted a dual title. So you could talk about it as the Hardcore Self-Help series, or you could say, you know, fuck anxiety, fuck depression, depending on the context, you know?
Genius. I like it. I think that's smart. Everybody's so sensitive these days, right? We got to be careful. We just throw in AKA bad words out there.
It's killed me on advertising though. I'm not allowed to advertise anywhere because I have a censored word in my titles, like not Amazon, not like Facebook, Twitter, anything like that. So you got to watch out for that if you want to, you know, follow suit.
Oh shit. Double-edged sword. Oh yeah. Man, beautiful title. It makes people go, yeah, I'm into what this guy's going to say. And dang, I didn't realize. So you couldn't put up a billboard or nothing, huh?
Well, you know, I can't do, you know, online advertising for a lot of different things. But you know, the title itself grabs attention, which has worked out pretty well for me. So I don't mind.
Well, as did your TEDx talk, man. The TEDx talk, you know, I just posted on our page here, but I loved it. It was heartfelt. It was honest. It was genuine. It really came from your heart, I could tell. You see some TED speakers, it's very scripted in a way. understanding it was scripted, but still in the idea that you delivered it from a real empathetic place. And it drew me in even further. And matter of fact, I just re-listened before we came on again.
Awesome. Thank you. I really, really appreciate it. Yeah, that was a crazy experience. You know, it was a TEDx conference, so it was smaller, but it was still the whole TED shebang, you know, standing in this little red dot, bright lights on you. You know, you can barely see the crowd cause it's all dark in the room and stuff like that. And it was like, walk out to the stage and bam, stand and deliver. And, you know, for me, it was a very personal message, you know, personally loaded at least. So, yeah, I'm happy that it went as well as it did. It was nerve wracking. But rewarding too, for sure.
So how was the anxiety before speaking on TEDx?
You know, it was pretty good. You know, my problem is actually dry mouth. When I get up on stage or I do a talk somewhere, anything like that, I go and I suddenly have no saliva at all. And you're just hearing like nastiness into the mic. And during the rehearsal, people were like, whoa, like I told them that was a problem, but they're like, no, I could actually hear it. So right beforehand, I had like these like citrus mints and I was like downing water, trying to get anything just to get things moving and lubricated. And it's different from like giving a talk at a school or teaching a class, because when I'm doing that, I can stop, take a drink of water. This one is more like a performance. So it's like, you just have to go for the whole, you know, 18 minutes or whatever and just get it done. So that was different for sure.
Yeah, I speak a little bit, and one of my scariest speeches I ever gave was to 1,500 high school students in a gymnasium with a handheld microphone. I had to keep their attention for an hour. And what I started doing, the dry mouth thing, is that I do coconut oil. And if I'm drinking coffee either pre-hand or something, I put it in there, or I'll even just rub it right underneath there. Cause on these podcasts, I do go hours.
Yeah.
And so I just kind of lube it up a little bit, you know, before you know it. And it gives you a little energy too, a little MCT, pumping through there at the same time.
I'll try that out. That's interesting.
Repackage coconut oil and call it like dry mouth speaking rub or something.
Yeah. I'm sure the bulletproof dude's already on that.
Shout out Dave Asprey, man. Yeah, he's definitely been bulletproofing just about everything you can, right? And so a lot of I love the basics of what your delivery is in the TEDx talk, the idea of complicated language use, the idea that people are intimidated, if you will, by mental health. And sure. I believe so that, you know, dialogue is so important in what we choose to use, right? And you do see a lot of that jargon, if you will. In my book, I use some, and kind of like you try to take the angle of going, look, what they're really saying here with all this irrational, rational, you know, is this simplified look. Mm-hmm. And can you speak more on when you first started noticing the language as being a problem, when it was noted an impact on the clients or people dealing with mental health?
Yeah. I mean, I've always been, you know, it's been a value of mine to kind of always be like a normal person. You know, I've gone through a lot of school. I did like, you know, what, something like 21 years straight of school from, you know, as a kid all the way through a PhD program without stopping. And so, you know, I've been in education for a long time. A lot of people were very smart. And you know, either when I'm TAing a class, you know, as a graduate student or with therapy clients that I've had, the biggest impact I've been able to make is when I just allow myself to be a real person. It's like, I have all this knowledge in there and that's fine. That's still going to be there regardless of what types of words I use to convey that. And I found that people often have a really negative association to mental health treatment or even, you know, just mental health education, because maybe they had a therapist or a professor or somebody that just did not level with them, didn't make it clear, didn't make it understandable. And so, you know, they're hearing all these crazy terms, you know, misattribution of interoceptive cues and cognitive distortions and, you know, schemas and all these different things. And they're like, whoa, you know, I'm barely keeping up with you here. You know, just like when I'm talking to somebody, I just did a talk recently with a bunch of law enforcement people and, you know, they were throwing out a bunch of acronyms from law enforcement and from the military. And I'm like, okay, I can get like 40% of these, but when you're not getting the whole thing, it's hard to really connect, you know? So, I've gotten a lot of feedback in my own personal clinical work that, one thing that has set me apart and helped people out a lot is just talking like a normal person. You know, there's no need to be lofty and crazy with things. And, you know, certainly there are terms that need to be used sometimes, but you could always clarify that. You know, if I'm teaching you about something about your brain, yeah, I'm going to say hypothalamus, or, you know, I'm going to say amygdala, but then I'm going to tell you that the amygdala is the part that just throws the panic switch in your brain. You know, you can explain it in normal terms as well. So that's kind of where it came from. And then, you know, the whole thing with my TED talk was that it impacted me in a really personal way when my wife was going through mental health treatment. And, you know, she's a totally awesome, normal, successful person, but has these struggles with anxiety, depression, some other issues. And she tried to get intervention, but, you know, the books that she was given, the intervention through therapy, those things were in this other camp where they're just not relatable. And it was really hard for her to grasp them and apply them because it just didn't feel like something that made sense to her. And that led to eventually, you know, declining and being hospitalized, which was really frustrating and pissed me off. So that's kind of the whole thing that prompted my, you know, book series and trying to be more of a mental health influencer and educator and stuff like that, aside from just my normal clinical work.
Yeah, that's, in Florida, we call that the Baker Act, right? The harm to self for others, right? Uh-huh. And a huge point, because I've worked with people or clients just talking to them, and they get very apprehensive to say the words that I've even thought about suicide, right? Or the idea, so they stay away from it. And as a helper, when you're trying to talk about the authenticity of the thoughts and the feelings. And I've had many clients, right? They go, I want to say something, but I don't want the white jacket to be rushing through here in any minute and tote me out of here.
Yeah. I have a chapter in my book on depression where I talk about that. It's literally called A Chapter About Suicide. And it starts off saying like, you know, suicide, like there, I said it, you know, I said the word. It's not like Beetlejuice. You don't say it three times and suddenly, you know, you're hospitalized. It's not like Voldemort. You don't need to like, you know, hush tones and stuff like that. It's a real thing that happens. And often not talking about it is the thing that, you know, makes a negative difference. And so in my approach, you know, I try to take the same frame of mind where I break things down and make things relatable. Also with that, where, you know, I can tell that somebody has been, you know, either thinking about suicide or has, you know, struggled with it in the past or is just having a fleeting thought, whatever the case may be. Let them know what the frame is up front. Like, these are the things that if I'm worried about, this will lead to a hospitalization. These are the things that won't. Here are the limits. Now that you have this information and container, let's talk about it like as much as you're willing to and as real people.
Yeah, I like that. I tried to reach back into my textbooks, right, and go, so what did they tell me, right? And it's the minute it's very structured, right? The minute you hear this, you do this, and you take this approach. And it's very black and white in the studies of what we're supposed to do. And I think that's a reality, you know, in people's lives. And you see it, you know, like just recently, you know, with Chris Cornell. And there was someone close to someone I love very much that decided that. And like you said, when you are intimidated by the use of your own language or even the language being used to you about what you're experiencing and what you're going through, it begins, right, to get like bottled up. You know, they won't talk about it, which is what you said is the important part.
Absolutely. And then they'll struggle with it on their own, you know, and they'll acquire influence from other places. You know, ideally, you as a helping professional, you know, or a family member or whoever this is applying to, you're supposed to be the one that they're able to go to. But when they can't, they develop these, you know, they got themselves into this position through having usually a little bit messed up thinking patterns, things that are self-defeating, things that are very black and white, stuff like that. And so that's what they're left with. And they're left to try to make sense of the situation through that lens that got them there in the first place, you know? And so that's not helpful. And so when they're too intimidated or too just afraid, unsure, whatever, to talk openly about it with you, with whoever, you know, whether you're a therapist or a coach or whatever, then oftentimes it just continues to, you know, fester and build up. And of course, there's plenty of resources that aren't helpful. You know, there's a lot of Tumblr things or, you know, forums or Instagram people that are also suffering from the same thing in silence that will help support the negative side of it, you know, but if you're not able to talk about it, it's going to be hard to, you know, pull yourself out. So I think that it's our responsibility as people who are influencing and people who are trying to help to set the ground and be able to have an open forum to talk about that comfortably.
Yeah, I have actually a question for you, and I would probably follow it for you of saying, everyone, it's not medical advice. He's not giving you mental health advice. It's a simply opinionated question that I'm asking between two people. Tell someone or suggest someone to do that maybe the person that the one contemplating suicide is coming to, right? A friend, maybe not a loved one, but a direct friend. I know a lot of people that get trapped in that. What do I do, right? I can't enable it. I can't I can't continue to be there like that, right? How would someone like that approach it?
So if I'm hearing correctly, so if you're the person that this struggling individual comes to and says, I've been having these thoughts, like, what do I do? Is that what you're asking?
Correct. If somebody's basically telling you they're thinking about committing suicide, but you're not a mental health professional or a loved one or a spouse, and you happen to be the friend that they're coming to.
Yeah, I think there's no perfect answer, and you got to realize that. And the best thing you can do is be honest. You know, like you could say, wow, that's really scary to me, but I'm happy that you brought that to me. That means, you know, I appreciate that you trust me with this. I haven't the slightest clue where to begin with this. This is like way over my head, but I do care a lot and I love you. And maybe I can help connect you to resources. You know, I know that at least there's this suicide hotline that everybody talks about. We can call if you need me to drive you somewhere to like go see a professional. I'm willing to do that. You know, I don't think any amount of my love is going to break you out of that because, you know, I've been loving you this whole time and here we are. But whatever I can do to support you, I'm there for. And often, you know, a person who's in a crisis situation or is suicidal or something like that, they're not going to know exactly what you can do. You know, they're not going to say like, oh, I know exactly what you should do to support me. It's more about being honest and letting them know that you are there. So when they do have maybe a moment of clarity or they're in a situation where they do need somebody to do something specific, you come to mind as somebody that is willing to do that thing. You know, so maybe they need somebody there to, you know, hang out with them, rub their back, just sit next to them while they call a suicide hotline or, you know, drive them to an appointment or, you know, call them to make sure they follow through with something. But it's different for everybody. And the best thing that you can do, I think, is kind of be honest with it and not be like, okay, well, everything's going to be okay. I'm going to make things better, you know, because you don't know if you can or not, but you do know that you care. And that's probably the most important thing to them anyway.
That's a beautiful answer. I think that's a wonderful approach. And, you know, with suicide, a lot of times, you see it. I kind of want to tell the story, but I don't want to be personal with someone, but they go from one day being just fine and with friends. And then the next day it's a post, you know, to social media and they're gone. And it touches so many people. And a lot of this, I would say, is fueled by an anxiety and depression, the two books you wrote about. And can you walk me kind of through your professional or personal opinion of depression, if you will, of how you see it manifest, all the way up to what someone experiences, et cetera. And then maybe it's a long question, or correlate that from depression to the differences of anxiety and how anxiety plays a role, how they may work together, that.
Yeah. So they coexist really well. Basically, you could think of it as like depression is about hopelessness. It's about not feeling like you can make a difference. And it's a lot about regret. So it's very based in the past and feeling like you've already learned from the past that the future isn't going to get any better. Anxiety is more about anticipation. It's worries about things that are coming up, you know, fears for things that might happen. And it's kind of the opposite end of the coin, where you feel like you need to do something, but there's no option for you to do something to resolve whatever that buildup is, you know? And so they really coexist well together. Oftentimes people have depression that's secondary to anxiety, meaning they have anxiety and that causes them to get worked up, to have, you know, maybe some really big physical symptoms, and maybe they miss out on a day of school or work. And then they feel depressed because of that. They feel guilty because of that. And it just kind of goes in a cycle, you know? So, you know, depression is really, like I said, about that. It looks a little bit different for everybody. For some people, it's very physical. For some people, it's, you know, having no energy, low motivation. You know, they're just kind of slowed down and they really take a physical hit from it. Other people, they're more like sorrowful and they're actually just really sad and, you know, maybe tearful, crying. And the thing about depression is it's a difficult one because it does the very thing to you that it needs to survive. I often think of depression as like a parasite. It feeds on the guilt, the hopelessness, the questions that it raises in your mind. It feeds on that to keep it strong, you know? So it'll say, okay, you know, you don't feel good enough to go to work today. And then you feel guilty for letting your team down. And then it says, that's delicious. That's exactly what I need to keep going. And so it gets you into that spiral, which is why when you're suffering through it in isolation, it's really easy to just keep going down and down and down and down and down. It kind of takes something to break that cycle in order to shake it up a little bit. You know, that's why therapy, medication, groups, coaching, basically anything is effective for depression, you know, if you allow yourself to go there and if you can find the motivation to do it. But that's kind of the crux of it for depression, where there are a lot of things that are very helpful, and most people with depression know that they're going to be helpful if they do it. You know, all the stupid stuff, you know, exercising more, getting more positive personal contacts, eating well, you know, all these different things. But if you're already depressed, you usually don't have the wherewithal or the motivation to do it, which is why enlisting the help of others, whether they're professionals or family, people to keep you accountable, things like that, is so important, because it's really hard to dig yourself out on your own. That's kind of the whole essence of the disorder, you know, or, you know, just the situation. Some, you can have a depressive disorder, or you can go through a depression without really having a diagnosed disorder. Same experience, just to different extents, I think, you know? So
yeah, that's keep going.
I was going to say that's kind of how I understand, you know, depression. And like I said, it looks different for everybody. Some of it is rooted, you know, more in the past. Some of it's rooted more in the present. Some of it's even rooted more in the future. But the thing is, often it plays tricks on you, where a lot of people who are very depressed feel like they're the only one who actually sees the truth. They're like, okay, I came to this realization and I've been having the wool pulled over my eyes for my whole life. And now I realize that actually I'm just worthless. I'm a piece of shit. Everybody's been fooling me. Like, there's, you know, there's nothing I could do about that. And so they feel like they came to this realization, and it's just a really tricky sort of thing. It's a really tricky sort of disorder. So, you know, there's a reason a ton of people suffer from it. It gets you, you know, but it's also one of the more treatable disorders. Depression and anxiety, in terms of psychiatric disorders, are some of the more treatable ones, much easier than, say, schizophrenia or bipolar or borderline personality disorder, some of these more, you know, quote unquote, severe things. Everything's on a spectrum, but at least these ones we've been working on for quite a while, and there are a lot of good things you could do for it. Yeah.
Beautiful. That's exactly why I'm asking you, man. I mean, you wrote the book on, I don't want to say dumbing down the language, but really trying to make relatable language for things like depression and scary words like anxiety. And that's exactly what I was asking for. If you could extend further into that with your ability to transfer words like that, I enjoy that. Is the difference, if you will, between what a normal worry of life experience would be like versus a diagnosable anxiety disorder?
Okay, yeah, for sure. Like everybody, for both depression and anxiety, it is understandably confusing because they're both an emotion and a class of disorders, right? You can feel depressed, and that doesn't necessarily mean you have depression. You could feel anxious, that doesn't mean you have anxiety, you know? Before you give a big speech, when you have a big exam coming up, the day of your wedding, these are all times that you've probably felt anxiety. And it's very similar to the anxiety that somebody who has like a general anxiety disorder feels, but it's situational, right? It's about that situation. And when the situation's resolved, it usually goes away. Now, there's a ton of different types of anxiety disorders. You know, the most common one is what's called generalized anxiety disorder. And that's just basically that feeling of anticipation and worry and fear that you have before one of those big events. It's kind of always there, but it's sort of just a low and slow version where you never feel resolved. You never feel easy. You never feel like you can really rest in your mind. There's always something that's unresolved, and there's a tension there. There's a sense of looming, like impending doom. And that's really uncomfortable. You know, it's biologically, it's really related to that whole fight or flight response that happens. You know, when you're standing in an intersection and a car comes barreling through because they missed the red light, your body adapts really quick to get you to be able to jump out of the way and survive. But the thing is, that reaction, that stress reaction, is meant to be temporary. It's really hard on your body. It's hard on you. And so it's meant to be a split second thing. But when you have like generalized anxiety, that process is still playing out in the background over time. And so it can be really exhausting. It's not supposed to be sustained for that long, you know? And then of course, somebody who has generalized anxiety, when they do encounter these legitimately stressful situations, then they're gonna peak because their baseline is already up here, you know? It's kind of like if you drink a bunch of coffee in the morning, you're already gonna be really jittery. And then if you encounter something that's really stressful, you might just puke, you know, because your baseline is already too high. So it's kind of like that. But like I said, there's a ton of different anxiety disorders out there. The main difference is the impact that it has on your life. So in order to qualify for like a psychiatric disorder, in addition to having these particular, you know, different criteria for different disorders, it has to cause some sort of impairment in your life. So maybe you're not as able to effectively work, or it's ruining some of your personal relationships, or it's really damaging your health, you know, things like that. So it has to have some sort of practical impact on your life. And that's really the biggest distinction there. You know, people will say, oh, my OCD is flaring up, or oh, my anxiety is flaring up because they like things to be orderly, or they get nervous sometimes. They don't like talking to other people. But, you know, if they're able to do it anyway, if they're able to successfully navigate about the world, you wouldn't necessarily consider them to have an anxiety disorder. But the good thing about skills, coping strategies, and all the underlying information about depression or anxiety is that they apply to both, you know, whether or not you qualify for like, you know, whether you're part of the club and have an anxiety disorder or a depressive disorder, the same principles apply. It's the same thing. It's just in a slightly different, you know, format, a different flavor. So it still applies there.
Beautiful, man. I think you're referencing a word that I think we hear sometimes, at least people that have been involved in the mental health, is the biopsycho. So it's kind of, I forget, what do you call it? What do you call PO again?
Oh, pedantic obfuscation.
Yes, yes. I was pronouncing like pedantic opposite. Yeah.
You have no idea how many times I practiced that. You know, I'm about to go on stage and say it a bunch of times, like pedantic obfuscation, pedantic obfuscation, pedantic obfuscation. Yeah, it's a tough word. And it's intentionally tough. It's supposed to be ironic, you know, because it's doing the exact thing that it's describing.
Right. Well, now that we're on it explain why we're there, what you mean by that.
So pedantic obfuscation is a term that I kind of coined with the help of a friend of mine for my TED Talk, where I was trying to describe when people use unnecessarily complicated language And that actually separates you from their point. It dulls the meaning of it because you have to kind of chew through the words. And so, you know, pedantic obfuscation basically means when somebody's kind of going on and on and on pointlessly, and the purpose of that is to obscure their words. And so basically it's supposed to just be an ironic term because it does the exact thing that it's describing, you know. But in my talk, I argue that we kind of use that as a defense mechanism. You know, I actually see it a lot on Twitter these days where people will say, oh, well, the blah, 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 this ism and the blah, 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 ism and, you know, things like that. They use a ton of really big words. And I think that often people use that to hide behind because it makes you unapproachable. It's hard for somebody to challenge you on that because they're like, well, shit, I don't know what that means. So I'm not going to say that you're wrong, you know? And so I think that when you remove that pedantic obfuscation, when you keep things more straightforward, it empowers the other person to be able to actually engage with you, which should lead to better clarity. You know, one of the most interesting in therapy. So I do psychotherapy, regular, you know, what you might think of as talk therapy, you know, on a chair, a couch, all that stuff with adults. And one of the most interesting experiences that a lot of people don't realize is sometimes the greatest nugget of truth can come out of misunderstanding. You know, when somebody says something to me and I say, wow, it sounds like you're really, really ashamed of that. And they go, I wouldn't use that word. I don't think I'm ashamed. I go, okay, great. So what are you feeling? And then from there you dive deeper and get to the real meaning, you know?
I do like that. But I mean, come on, that's how us psychologists and mental health people, right? That's what we do, is we use big words to sound really smart so we can weave stuff together when we're really just telling you that you have some things to work out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it happens all the time. With other professionals too. I certainly I can hold my own and I can talk in those terms, but I don't always like to, you know. Sometimes there's a perfect term for something and you need to use it. Other times I'm like, dude, shut up, like talk like a normal person. I'm, you know, I'm off the clock here.
Yeah, I think you get that, man. And before I sidetrack this there, mm-hmm. with confusing language, I was using some more confusing language, is the idea of that biopsychosocial, if you will, that we walk into that and what that means. Because I've talked about on my show before where I say, you know, in order to classify as mental health, it has to impact the biopsychosocial, being very guilty of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Hell, the name of my show is guilty of what you're saying. I could just say a thinking rampage, but it being an Ellis fan, right? It's a cognitive rampage, but yeah. If you would.
Well, what do you mean by it? I mean, I hear the term too, biopsychosocial, and I mean, I think it means different things in different contexts. So when you're talking about it on your show, what do you mean?
What I'm meaning is the biological impact, right, of what it has on your actual body, the mm-hmm. social impact. Oh, I see what you're doing here. You set me up to say exactly how you'd say it. Yeah. Oh, man, the man's good. The man's good. Yeah, it would be impacting. I usually follow by saying that impacts your biology, impacts your social, whatever that being, relationships mm-hmm. or, you know, jobs, work, et cetera, as well as your thinking, right?
Yeah. The social part, you know, I like to think of it in terms of your relationship to others, your relationship to yourself, and your relationship to, like, the greater system, you know? So, you know, your family, your relationships with yourself, and then the greater system, like school, the society that you live in, your city, your country, things like that, you know? So it can impact any level of those.
I love it, man. That's what when I first was reading about your approach, I was going, yes, yes. And then I realized, oh, it would have to be a new mind in psychology, right? That's coming in and seeing this and the way you break that down for people. Cause I believe it is so important because those words can be so intimidating to people. Even the diagnosis words themselves or the predispositions they talk about, right? Or everything that makes you sit there and sometimes lose your mind.
Yeah. And you know, the funny thing is, like, we do a whole full circle thing where, you know, the DSM is the diagnostic manual for psychologists in the United States. You know, it's like this thick and it has all the different disorders in there and it lists all the bullet points. So what we do is we learn this stuff. We actually learn all the criteria for the most part. You know, well, of course, we reference it ourselves and stuff like that. And then we take away all those criteria and then slap a label on it. So instead of asking, okay, do you experience this and this and this and this, we say, do you think you're depressed, or do you think you're bipolar, or do you think you have a phobia? And, you know, instead, if we actually just did the same crap that we're doing in our mind out loud, it can really help people connect more. Like, are you ever experiencing periods where you don't sleep for, you know, several days and you're feeling elevated, like you're on top of the world? You maybe have a lot of ideas that you start but never finish, never follow up on, you know, and that would be describing a manic episode. But nobody knows what a manic episode means, you know?
I'm glad actually you're on that, because one of the most overdiagnosed things that I hear all the time, self-diagnosed, I might add, is the idea of, I know you didn't write about it, but bipolar. And this idea, can you walk through what that means, where it comes from really, and the differences between what a manic episode really is, et cetera. Yeah. And please try to help clarify for some people that walk around and go, well, my mood changes every 5 minutes all the time. I'm, you know, can you please walk through that?
Sure. I can't fault anybody that does that, because, you know, there's just a lot of bad information out there, or lack of good information rather, you know? So, you know, I can't fault anyone for saying, oh yeah, I'm bipolar. Oh yeah, I'm OCD, when they actually don't qualify for those disorders. But, and again, it doesn't help that these terms are also descriptors, you know, like if you read a book or see a movie that has like a schizophrenic quality or a bipolar sort of quality to it, that's a descriptor in its own right. But it's not referring to like the psychiatric disorder. But yeah, bipolar does not mean mood swings. It doesn't mean some days you're feeling good, some days you're sad. The real most important aspect of it is actually the manic phases. So it used to be called manic depression, meaning you have periods of mania and then you have periods of depression. And the periods of mania they're like artificially elevated moods. So basically you have periods where you're running on a motor. You're really high in energy. Maybe you're not sleeping for several days and don't feel the need for sleep. Often you have impairment in your judgment. So you're making bad decisions or impulsive decisions. You're not able to hold yourself back from doing dumb things that you might normally be able to hold yourself back from. For instance, a lot of people will, you know, they'll start a new business, or they'll sell their house, or they'll do really impulsive things that later on they regret. And so this period lasts for a while, you know, it could last several weeks, or there's different sort of criteria. Some people cycle more rapidly than others. And there's also other overlapping things, like maybe you're more prone to go use drugs or engage in promiscuous behavior or something like that, because again, that filter is sort of off during that time. And then you switch to the depressive mode. And that's just like the depression that we had talked about before. And so you can go into kind of a full depression. And oftentimes when they go back to back like that, the depression is even deeper, because you have all the regrets and all the guilt and all the things that crash off the end of the manic phase. So it's a really tough sort of thing. And it's really hard to treat, because honestly, it feels good to be manic. You know, it's like when you're high on coke or something like that, it's like, it feels good in those moments. And so you don't necessarily want to change at that time. And then when you come off of that, you're feeling too racked by guilt and, you know, being lethargic and having to recover, that you don't want to do anything about it. So that swing back and forth makes it a difficult disorder to treat, particularly without medication. You know, the class of medications that are used for that are called mood stabilizers, and they try to make those swings, you know, closer together and less severe, so that you can have a little bit more presence of mind to put in that work. And I think with almost any sort of psychiatric difficulty, the whole point is you want to try to capitalize on those moments of clarity that you have to kind of set yourself up for success. So even if you don't have bipolar, if you have depression, or you're just a normal person who sometimes struggles a lot more than other times, you're going to have a natural rhythm to your own mood, to your own, like, how awake you are, how alert you are, you know, all these different things. And it's really important, in my opinion, to have some self-awareness about what your patterns are, because you don't want to try to force yourself to be on 100% perfect all the time. That's unrealistic. But what you can do is you can use those times when you are on to try to set yourself up for the times that you're not. So maybe you know that sometimes you're really motivated, you're feeling great, you're having a good day. You can use that time to maybe set up some structure for those times when you would typically just like sit on the couch and binge watch an entire, you know, four seasons of something, and then feel bad about it later on. So using that presence of mind and having that self-awareness to know your patterns.
Beautiful, sir. Beautiful, sir, man.
I know we went off the mark from a bipolar a little bit there, but you know, that's how it goes.
that's kind of what I really wanted to pull out here was your ability to do that, to transfer the words from scary things to the people just self-diagnosing randomly, or those that also discount mental health diagnosis, right? You'll hear that person say, well, that's just life. That's what we normally do. And you mentioned giving it the label, et cetera, and how empowering or how important that can or cannot be. How much or how impactful do you see labels like that when we start attaching them?
Labels are interesting, man. They're very interesting because on one hand, they're good and bad. You know, they're just there. Labels can be really empowering in some cases because it gives you a name. You know, there's somebody that I saw recently on social media that I'm not going to mention who, but they were diagnosed with PTSD. And they realize that, holy crap, all this stuff that's been so confusing really fits under that umbrella. And this is the monster that I've been dealing with. And so it was really empowering, scary, but also empowering to know that there's something that you can call it, you can address it, and it's something that there's research on and it's treatable and things like that. You know, so it can be really positive there. But, you know, it could also be stigmatizing, you know, like to say that you have a psychiatric disorder, that you're disabled in some sort of way is like, man, like I still have both my legs, you know, I can still breathe on my own and things like that. I'm not disabled, right? But, you know, so there's positives and negatives about the labels. I try to put as much stock in them as is appropriate for the situation. But in the end, they are just labels. You know, it's trying to use a shorthand to describe a collection of experiences that some people have had. And even between two people with PTSD or two people with bipolar, their experiences are going to be vastly different because they're two different people, you know? So there's only so much you can reduce it down, but it's a shorthand.
Oh, man, it's a double-edged sword, right? Because I too believe in the power of identifying what it is. But I guess I'm on that same conundrum philosophy, right? Because if I'm talking about it's important, right? You pointed out that's what it is. You can, you know, structure better approaches to beat it, to overcome it, et cetera. But then again, when you do point that out and say, this is what it is, we get those self-fulfilling prophecies, right? We get the idea of that's who I am rather than separating what I'm being affected by.
Sure. Sure. And there are some, I mean, the thing is, there are some disorders that are more supportive of that, you know, like depression. So when you have depression, that's one where the label is pretty appropriate, but it also becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. But that's also just the nature of the disorder, you know? So I try not to lose too much sleep over labels because sometimes they serve a really good purpose. Sometimes they don't. But like, if you spend so much time, you know, worrying about the label, you're ignoring all the crap underneath. That's the stuff you should be paying attention to, you know? So they're important. They're also difficult. They're something that's always going, they're always going to be both, I think.
Yeah. How much, two-part question. I'll probably get tangential. I use that word ever since I had to write it in notes, and I think it's hilarious. So I'm like, there's circumstantial, tangential. I'm like, they actually have a difference. I'm like, the note writing's ridiculous. The fact that the way you have to word it, I'm like, this is not what the person is dealing with, but I have to structure it like that. Two parts, I guess, before I get too squirreled off. What's your stance, if you will, on diagnosis being theoretical based and not signed, basically, whether that be depression, bipolar, pick one, as being theoretical based and not provable for one? That's probably going to be long, so I'll pitch the second question after that one.
Okay. Well, they're both. You know, I mean, we're in a day and age like right now. I honestly believe that. You know, probably in 15 years, we will be really close to being able to like do blood tests and different things like that to tell, you know, very closely, like whether you have depression or these different, you know, psychiatric disorders, because a lot of them do have differences in biology and stuff like that. But I think that they kind of describe the same thing, you know, when, for instance, another part of what I do in my work is what's called neuropsychology. So it's basically psychology of the brain. I'll do low tech, tests with people. So tests of memory or concentration or their multitasking or language. And through that, I can identify whether there are issues with their brain. Now you can also do a brain scan and notice where there might be problems. You can do an MRI or a SPECT scan or whatever and notice these differences in the brain. but they work together complementary. You know, my approach is a little more theoretical, I guess, because I'm just seeing the evidence and what that points to. And in a brain scan, they're looking at the physical differences and what that probably implies. So you're kind of attacking it from both sides. And, you know, in the development of, you know, the DSM, our diagnostic manual, or the ICD, which is another one, they try to base it in biology as much as they do in theory. And ideally they should converge a bit and, you know, at some point. So I think both sides of it are important, you know, and the other thing is, like I described with my work, where say I look at somebody's brain and they have a ton of these plaques and tangles that typically are involved in Alzheimer's disease. That doesn't mean I can tell you looking at the picture how good or bad their memory is, you know, or how it's impacting their life on a day-to-day basis, or even if they qualify for dementia, right? Which would be like the level of impairment in memory and stuff like that, that they get to. So, you know, the scientific markers of that, you know, biologically are helpful, but they don't tell the whole story. So I think it's always important to have like the theoretical stuff underneath that to bolster it and to fill in both sides.
I couldn't agree more that they got to work together. And I think a lot of people also do fail to understand sometimes that what they're dealing with is theoretical basis, that it's not necessarily, like you said, there's different kinds of depression, anxiety, there's different variations and ways of it. And so kind of a forewarning, if you will, of the labels of study, research, science, like the guy who came up with the idea of stress, right? Mm-hmm. We have to call it something to study it so we kind of know what we're doing rather than just directly associating it. And I had Dr. Andrew Hill on here, a neuroscientist as well. And, you know, we talked a lot about the brain scans, et cetera, and, mm-hmm. you know, how he was trying to figure out, you know, this brain image is close to ADHD. We're not sure. He said that was the closest diagnosis they had come to be able to prove anything with a brain scan and mental health disorders.
Yeah. Yeah. ADHD, you see a lot of differences in like the, you know, the frontotemporal, so the front and sides of your brain, because that's the place that is impacted, you know, and it's really trippy when you kind of bridge those gaps like I do in my work between seeing how it plays out on paper and through testing and then in the imaging and biology of it, because, you know, sometimes it lines up so well and you see, you know, these tests that we have that are based in this part of the brain, people have more variation in that when they have ADHD, and then it shows on the brain scan. So in some areas like that, they really do converge quite well. And other areas too, like for instance, if somebody has a stroke or a traumatic brain injury where there's actually just an injury to a localized part of the brain, that it's like, it shows it's such a great correlation on the skills that we're testing versus the area that's damaged, you know? So sometimes things do converge really well like that, for sure.
Yeah. I'm a fan of the science, most definitely. And for me, what really got me with psychology is how young it really is, how young Sure. we've really started with theories. I remember sitting there thinking, I'm like, you know, I don't want to be an archaeologist. They already found all the cool stuff. You know, I'm like, all right, what could you do? And when I got more into this, I'm like, it's still such a young field, if you will, about theories and what we're learning and what we yeah. know. And, you know, I'm a fan of all the research, biologically, all of it. And, you know, for me, I probably went your route too and went more the brain study, more neuroscience. I would have went mm-hmm. that way as well. I do see those linking up over time. It's almost inevitable. And I'm a fan of anyone doing that research, trying to be able to do that. So we could actually say, no, it's not a theory. Here's the, you know, a biological presence that we really see. I'm a huge fan of that. And to kind of connect the two, though, that's what usually scares me about pharmacological or pill interventions, is because they're also theory based on how the brain works or what it does to the brain. And we mix kind of a theory based medicine pill that then affects the brain, that's kind of theory based as well, on a diagnosis that's theory based. And it seems so scary to me. It seems like a sure. big risk.
So let me talk a little bit about my thought process with medication. And I'm not a psychiatrist, so I'm not a medical doctor that focuses on medication. But medication doesn't fix any problems for you, right? It may fix some problems in terms of, like, you know, if you're bipolar, it will fix the fluctuation and the amplitude the size that happens at. But really what it does is it pairs really well with therapy or other interventions, because it opens you up. It gives you the space to actually put the work in to make those changes. You know, because if you just solve something with a pill, with some sort of biological change, when you pull that away, typically it's going to come back. You're going to relapse on that because you haven't kind of built up anything. So I usually think of it as, you know, if medication does this to you and raises you up, the other interventions of group work or therapy or self-help build scaffolding underneath so that once you pull away that medication, you're still elevated up there, you know? And I almost never suggest just the medication approach on its own. You got to kind of pair them, you know, because medication isn't going to change the structure of your life. It's not going to change the people that you surround yourself with. It's not going to change your early childhood experiences and the insight that you have about those. It's just going to reduce the crippling burden of your symptoms so that you can come to some of those insights, or you can make some of those changes in your life, or so that you can enact some of those coping skills that you know are better and more healthy. You know, so you got to pair the two, I think.
Yeah. And hopefully the medication will lift that up, right? It becomes kind of a roll of the dice sometimes. And I guess, you know, we got to be scientists in all areas, right?
Well, that's what we're getting closer to. So like I said, in like the 10 to 15 years, we're going to be a lot better able to say, okay, let's take some samples and we know what medication is going to do the trick for you, right? So that's going to be a really important thing. So we're not there. Unfortunately, there is some trial and error right now. And that's really uncomfortable for people when you're, you know, screwing with your biology. Like let's raise this level of neurotransmitter. Let's bring this one down and see what happens, see how you react. But that's also the scientific method. You know, you got to try something with a hypothesis and then, you know, prediction of what's going to happen, see how that lines up with it. And if it's not there, then adjust course, try again and stuff like that. But, over time, we're definitely going to be able to reduce the amount of trial and error that needs to happen. Because of course we say in the field, there's no such thing as a free lunch in terms of biochemistry. You know, when you do fiddle with this thing, it's not going to have just a tiny localized effect. It's going to also impact other systems in your body or even other areas in the brain. For instance, medicine for Parkinson's. So Parkinson's disease, you know, yeah, it's a movement disorder, and that's caused by having too little dopamine in one part of the brain. Well, when you have too much dopamine in a different part of the brain, what you get is schizophrenia. So oftentimes people who are taking really high doses of Parkinson's medication will start getting hallucinations like people with schizophrenia, you know, so there's no free lunch, but what we're ideally going to be able to do when we, you know, converge more on that is take some of the guesswork out of the equation and apply this treatment just like you would to a headache or any other physical issue that's really well understood and well managed.
Yeah, I think what you brought up is important too, is that it doesn't change your social, it doesn't change your environment, it doesn't change a lot of times what you're wanting to think, right, or believe, like you said, about what we've been through. And I think that's important too. I'm glad you pointed that out, is that magic pill society sometimes that I refer to, looking for that weight loss pill and that smart pill and that limitless pill all at the same time.
But to be clear, there are, you know, there is a range, right? When you're talking about like low level depression and anxiety, that's one thing. But when you're talking about like you have very severe bipolar, or you're schizophrenic to the point that you're not able to operate in, you know, our society or something like that, the treatment approach indicates medication, because there's not a whole lot you can do aside from that to really bring things down to a level where you can make a difference, you know. And that's just just a shitty hand that you were dealt in terms of biology. You know, a lot of these things have an inherited disposition, and then something kicks it off and you're in that mode, you know? So that's, you got to recognize that there's a range too. When people think of, oh, you know, psychiatric medication, a lot of times they just think of like the worried well, and people who are having too much stress, or people who, you know, maybe are sad too often, not people who are like completely unable to live a successful life because of their mental disorder.
Correct. I think a lot of people do forget, and I may even skip over, about those people that are dealing with that have tried every holistic method and social influence, et cetera, that have really reached those deep places. For sure. I think it's definitely, and it's the science that we're living in. It's the theory of the science that we're in the field. And that's why I think it's still beautiful, because we all are all trying to find a way to help each other be better and get better.
Yeah, there are scary things though. I mean, there's stuff that, you know, lithium is one of the old drugs for bipolar. We don't know why it works, but it does. You know, electroconvulsive therapy, people think that that's not a thing anymore. Totally is. It's one of the most effective treatments for depression that isn't it like is really sticky and it's hard to treat.
That's but it's like short term. It's like short term, right? I'm sorry, you're bringing up the shock therapy, which is cool. I remember learning. I'm like, they're still doing that? Like, what world are we in? And then I researched and I said, holy shit. Like, you have this real short term effect. Sorry to interrupt you, though.
Yeah. Well, I mean, basically, you know, it's managed in, you know, you go to a hospital, you're sedated, and it's scary because it initiates a seizure, basically, you know? And so they're shocking your brain, giving you a seizure. But it's done in a very controlled way, and it's done in a very specific protocol over time, you know, and you do so many sessions with it, and it's very effective, you know, and for some reason it serves as a sort of brain reset. Same thing with like hallucinogenics and, you know, with sometimes insulin shock or hypothermia or all these things kind of serve as like a reset button for your brain. And we don't know exactly why, but we know that it does work. So that there, you know, depending on your tolerance for that sort of like, I don't know why this is working, you know, that could be very, very scary for you.
Yeah. And the placebo effect is strong too. And just about whatever we try and believe inside. Yeah.
Yeah. And your beliefs about how well it's going to work are important, you know? Funny enough, some of the best work that I've ever done in therapy are with people who found me after I wrote my books, because they know my style. They have a preconception that this is going to work for them. So of course it's going to work for them.
Well, that worked out.
Yeah, exactly.
I was saying that worked out. But it's true. Our beliefs, I can't wait. I want to see the research later. I probably won't be around long enough. I don't know. But to see what a belief really is beyond just this thought that we've concreted, right, that we can explain through our experiences, environment, and nature, et cetera. But when we could really put the scientific behind, you know, what that belief really is.
Yeah, that's too philosophical for me right now. I can't even.
Right. I mean, if imagine being able to pinpoint what the belief is and where it comes from, and then simply being able to either biologically or neurologically change it and just go like, okay, let's just change the channel and be able to turn the belief like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's probably, you know, for most of our beliefs, probably up in the frontal part of the brain where we imagine things, you know, because that's like that's where our imagination is and our personality and stuff. Other than that, deeper in the brain is where we just learn stuff. So we have things that we've learned, you know, but some combination of the two is probably where that's at.
Well, is there anything new that you're seeing on the horizon or anything on the closer 2X scale rather than my out there SpaceX scale on in psychology, medication, or even neurology?
I mean, yeah, there's tons of stuff, you know, but, you know, that's a whole different conversation. The thing is, this is all like, all this stuff is not new. We're just finding new ways to describe it. You know, we're finding new ways to interpret it. You know, I was actually thinking the other day, like we're in a really interesting, psychology emerged at a really interesting time, because since it emerged, we've had like the biggest cultural revolution in history with the internet and social media and stuff like that. But, before that, it was just, you know, old white dudes writing in books and stuff. And if you look at books of like what Freud wrote or like other, you know, fundamental people in the field, like they wrote a lot of weird shit and they wrote a lot of stuff. It looks like a Twitter timeline of just like random thoughts at, you know, 11:58 PM and stuff like that. But a few of them hit, a few of them went viral. And that's what kind of became our fundamental understandings of how our, you know, brains and emotions work. So I have no idea, you know, 100 years from now, what that's going to look like, because now we're in this just rapid fire. Like everybody's got a podcast, everybody's got ideas, everybody's got, you know, this open forum for things. You know, I'm not sure how that's going to change.
Oh, that's fucking, I'm laughing my ass off, man. That's hilarious. Because you look back at some of the books that were written. I mean, and that's just, you're right. It's just kind of what people grab. People still reference Freud, and he's kind of a little old school other than some childhood stuff. But we're still hunting for the subconscious that he's pointed out, trying to prove its existence of some kind, which I don't think we've done that well, but, you know, you're right. They're just white guys that thought about some weird shit and wrote it in a book, and it came out at this time. But what a time, right? When we need it, right? When we have to kind of understand our psychology, when we're connecting, like you said, all over the world, like we take in so much information. Mm-hmm. Is our brain even fucking wired to process all that shit?
Yeah. I mean, I wonder, you know, we're definitely throwing evolution for a loop right now, because it's like, the pace that things are changing, who knows what sort of traits are going to be selected for, you know, a thousand years from now or whatever, because, you know, we're not going to have to think really, you know, like in terms of like, I have all the information I could ever want in the palm of my hand with my phone. So I don't have to know facts, you know, I have to be able to know how to reference them quickly and when to apply them and stuff like that. But, you know, definitely the requirements are changing. I feel the pressure of that right now, because I have a 1-year-old son. He's like 15 months old. And, you know, in terms of his interface. Thank you.
Shout out to you. What's his name?
Remy.
All right, Remy, when you're like 22 and you're listening to your dad go off, man, shout out to you, Remy.
Yeah, but like, you know, his wanting to use a phone or an iPad or different things like that. And, you know, there's a part of you, you know, I almost already feel like an old man sometimes when I'm like, no, you know, you don't need to play with that technology. You need to go play with sticks and stuff like that. But at the same time, if he doesn't know how to interface on this like one-to-one basis with that technology, he's going to get left behind too. So there, you know, the way we're being raised and adapting, it's real and it's just kind of representative of the times. But just as with every generation, there's this weird tension where you're kind of in between and you see the purpose of it, but it's also uncomfortable and all that stuff. You know, that's why I got a lot of that when I was doing my dissertation research, which was actually on internet-based psychotherapy. That's what I did my research on. And there's a lot of people who are really uncomfortable with that idea. You know, and yeah, I just basically tell people like, well, how are people communicating? They're communicating online. Wouldn't you want to use their primary form of communication?
I'm with you. You know, they said the same, right? For me, it was stop playing Tecmo Bowl. You're not going to know anything when you're trying to, you know, just be Walter Payton and run on the outside. Tecmo Bowl reference, but it was television and The Simpsons, right? You're going to go blind if you watch that. You're going to lose all your social communication abilities. And I'm like, mom, I'm communicating pretty well these days, right? And but we get older, we say the same. I find it with my daughter. I have a 17-year-old daughter, and social media is—it's almost like their third arm, right? It's like a part of them.
And yeah, 100%.
The most I've ever been able to—I just say, hey, look, just watch the blue light, all right? Look up the blue light; it'll make you blind, it'll screw you up. Just limit the blue light, and kudos, Dr. Jack Cruz, but. I don't know. It feels like maybe our bodies and our brains are like skateboards, like running a nitrous engine, and we're just not ready, right? And so you see all these other symptoms popping out. You see more mental health disorders. You see people just freak out. They just, right? If you scan social media for 5 minutes, man, for someone dealing with some shit in life, it can really make you go, oh my God. You know, you see the conspiracy theorists popping out. You see people diving down rabbit holes so easy. I don't know, man.
Well, it's an interesting question of chicken and egg, you know, and it's like, was this stuff always there? Is the prevalence rate of disorders and the existence of all these different types of people, were they always there? And now we're just seeing them? Or is it kind of, you know, the fact that this whole network allows them to thrive and come out, or is it a little bit of both? You know, I tend to think it's a little bit of both. You know, I think that people are more willing to talk about things and more willing to be open in themselves and things like that because of the internet. And, you know, because it's open and it's talked about, but, you know, there may be a little bit of the other side too, you know, but in the end, those are things that I'm like, when I reach that level of theoretical, I tend to pull things back and say, who gives a shit? Because there's actual stuff to work on.
Oh yeah. I got you. The age of dualism lives on, right? Everything's a double-edged sword. We find competence, we invent technology, and then we make the nuclear or hydrogen bomb.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, you know, humans, we are simultaneously the worst and the best at having mixed feelings about things. You know, that's, it's like one of the cruxes of the human experience is there's never a right answer, and you simultaneously have to embrace and fight that.
I think you just summed up mental health, man.
Maybe so. Write that one down.
I think you, yeah, you did. Well, we'll go back and listen to it. I think that's your next TEDx talk, my friend, is you're summing up the real idea of mental health.
All right. I'll work on it in my infinite free time. No.
Right. Oh man, I appreciate you coming on, man. What would you say if you had to look at someone that was dealing with anxiety or depression in that moment, or maybe they are seeking help, but however you wish to reach them, the way you were trying to reach them in your books talking about it, Can you try to give me a cognitive rampage, if you will, of what your books are trying to relay to those readers and those people that may not have read your book, but are in that in some area now?
If they're trying to get help, first, congratulations, like, good job. It's not easy to do, you know, these feelings that you're having are there because they trick you and because they try to keep you from seeking help and getting better, you know? So first off, you know, good job for that. And it's supposed to be confusing, you know, at a certain level, we weren't designed to deal with this crap. So you're not supposed to know how to deal with it. And that's okay. You know, that there's going to be guilt for that. There's going to be confusion. There's going to be a lot of mixed up feelings, and all of those are just going to be there, and it sucks, but it's real, you know? And the other thing is, when you assign these labels to yourself, when you say, you know, I'm using my depression as an excuse, or, oh, I shouldn't feel this way, or I should feel that way. Who gives a shit? That none of those things have any bearing on what is actually happening right now. You know, so what you have is what's going on right now. What you have is maybe some insight into where it's come from in the first place. So that's where you kind of need to live. That's where you need to work. And it takes work, but there's resources out there and there's people out there who are willing to help you capitalize on those things, you know? And so you may try some things that don't hit the mark, and that's okay. That doesn't mean that you failed. That doesn't mean that the thing that you tried failed. That means that it wasn't a good match this time, but that doesn't mean that the next thing isn't going to work really well. And if you keep trying different things, if you try to be a good scientist and notice the actual effect that things have on you, then eventually you can find that secret sauce and that thing that really clicks for you, and embrace that and run with that and make some positive changes for yourself, you know? And when you do that, you may circle back again and you may find yourself in the same situation, but at least you've learned the process for getting yourself out, or the process for making some progress, and you can apply that again. And, you know, maybe just looking at trying to do it a little bit faster each time. And, you know, when you do that, hopefully you can live a life that's, you know, consistent with your values, that's satisfying to you, and you can get there, and it will take work, but it's possible.
And that is the Duff the Psych Rampage. Hey, man, I appreciate it, man. That's, you got me shaking my head yes over here. Like, I'm just like, yeah, man. Yeah. I applaud you for writing those books, and taking a different look at mental health, and not just going, okay, this is what we say, this is what we do, and questioning the norms of how we practice in this field. And, I'm sure that's changing a lot of lives, just as, your books have. And I thank you for that. And where can everybody find your books, man?
I got a page, hardcoreselfhelp.com. It's just an arm of my website that has all the books there. You know, I got a lot of stuff going on. I always do. So I have those books, and I got a podcast of my own by the same name. It's just the Hardcore Self-Help Podcast, where I take listener questions each week. I just take 3 mental health questions or questions about life. Occasionally I'll do an interview or a deep dive on one particular subject. Like, I recently did an episode that was all about breathing, like strategies and why you should practice it and stuff like that. So I got those going on. But yeah, I mean, keeping up with me on social is probably the best way to know what I'm up to. I'm just at Duff the Psych on everything: Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc.
All right. Look that up. Duff the Psych. I like the podcast too, man. I dove into it. The breathing stuff is not new to me, like the Wim Hof stuff is, but what it actually does, that's the stuff that's where I'm getting, man, people aren't just saying breathe like this, to really see the effects that breathing like that really can have on your life. You know, I think a lot of times we think it's too complex. My problem's too complex, and we don't think things like that. But that was a great podcast, man. I enjoyed that one.
Oh, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
And I enjoyed this one, man. I love chatting with you, man. And
thank you so much for having me on. It's been a great conversation.
Come back anytime, man. I shout out to my buddy, Dr. Parker Mott, who's a psychologist, where I grew up with him. And he used to come over to the Cognitive Cave when I still lived in Florida, and we would just ramble on for hours about mental health and diagnosis, and have a sip of whiskey or two along the way, man. So if you ever feel like doing that, man, just... Yeah, if you ever feel like doing that, man, just say, hey, man, you want to go live? And let's go live and chop that shit up about mental health or what we're seeing, or give a rant or two, yeah?
That sounds good, man. Yeah, and if I'm ever going your direction, I'll hit you up, and maybe we could do the Cognitive Cave in person.
Yeah, I love it, man. I'm moving the cave here soon eventually. I've been out in the desert for a couple months, and I'm kind of a vagabonder, minimalist traveler. So all of the shit that I own fits into my little Ford Fusion. Nice. And including my big, almost now 30-pound half German, half pit bull Grayson, we venture. Brother, again, thanks for coming on, man. And everybody, look him up, please, at Duff the Psych. Duff the Psych, man.
All right, man. Thank you.
Anytime, brother. Take care. I hope you enjoyed that podcast. I really love those podcasts, as you could probably tell. I love talking in the wheelhouse that I love to dance around in, whether that's mental health, psychology, philosophy, and all those words that I was not able to pronounce on this episode, like neurology. sometimes my brain moves faster than my tongue can move and I can't keep up, but I really appreciate you coming on, Robert. It was good having you on. For me, y'all, looking at a young psychologist like that gives me hope a lot. You know, you may hear a lot from me being argumentative toward the system of mental health and the reactive nature to what it is and the theoretical sold as scientific fact that a lot of mental health can be. I am a supporter of the research in all those areas because we do need to know more. What I typically get upset about is how fast we start applying what we really don't know much of. It's kind of the idea of, hey, we can do this, but should we yet? Just because we have the technology, should we be applying it to people yet? You know, that's kind of where I question it. But on a podcast like this, and it gives me hope of a different change when guys like Robert are willing to question that and willing to point out the norms of the language we use, how we apply it, and how we approach helping other people. No, again, thanks for coming on. Thanks for listening, everybody. I am out of here this weekend. I fly out tomorrow. I will be in Florida, New Smyrna Beach, getting my surf on and some much needed vitamin D and sun. So looking forward to that. I hope you're taking care of you. I hope you have a safe weekend as well. And in case you don't know, the book's on Amazon. Check it out. Leave a review. It really helps. It's kind. If you're listening to the podcast, you can also donate. Help us keep this bad boy going. Some of the gear we replace, bringing on certain guests, etc. We've been doing this 2 or 3 years now. And keeping off advertisers, et cetera. But just you can go to cognitiverampage.com, throw a bone, throw a dollar, throw something if you like the show. I'm just a poor mental health counselor, y'all. But you can find the book on Amazon too. We'll be taking care of you. Go live your cognitive rampage. Have a beautiful, beautiful Memorial Day weekend. Be in the sun as much as you can, yeah? Get that vitamin D. Get that recharge. Get the electrons up there. Stay away from the blue light if you can this week. And I've been in front of it too long all week, so I'm looking forward to shutting it down. But, oh, yeah, a lot of big guests continue to come up. John Joe McFadden, the author of Life on the Edge, will be on the podcast Thursday. I believe it's June 1st at 9 a.m., we have a couple more authors, if you can tell the thread that we're going down. But we have a cannabis expert coming on to talk about the real scientific pharmaceutical facts of cannabis. We have a sex therapist coming on later. I mean, Pickett, really where I'm trying to stay focused on these podcasts is in the biological, the cognitive, the behavioral, and the social sciences, as well as the philosophers. I'm a huge believer. I think they're all really art forms, if you ask me. Science is an art, I believe. Mental health and psychology certainly is an art. But I think when maybe we combine the sciences and arts, we'll make some changes. Yeah, but that's what the show will be focusing on for a while now. And I'm trying to bring in those that write on those topics and bring you the competence that I'm chasing. I appreciate y'all sticking around and hanging out for so many years now. I think August will be coming up on 2 years. Yeah, August sometime will be a 2-year anniversary of the Cognitive Rampage. It's been a long road, y'all. It's a tough road. And if you're building the same path, whether it's a podcast or writing a book or starting a business or whatever it is, I think the key is to keep going. You know, keep taking the steps each day and don't give up on whatever it is you believe or what you have fun doing or whatever you're trying to make happen. And maybe it happens overnight, maybe it doesn't, but keep driving and keep pushing. Keep taking care of you. Love you.